Tonight we want to continue our study of some of the parables of Jesus, and we are continuing the Gospel of Luke. Luke begins this travel dialogue of Jesus and his disciples as they begin to make their way on this last journey to Jerusalem. Now we know what's at the end of that trip, right? The Lord Jesus himself is going to lay down his life for us so that we can have redemption through him. And so Luke records significant teaching encounters, miracles, as they are making their ways. The crowds come, the crowds go. There's always somebody else around besides the 12. Huge crowds have been following him. Crowds from not only Galilee, where they appear to be at this time, but also from Judea, south, down around Jerusalem, from Perea, which is across the Jordan, here where we live. Even up in the area above the Sea of Galilee, there were crowds coming from all around to hear more about and learn more about this Jesus. Tonight, we're going to take a look at a parable. I'm calling it the shrewd manager because the text itself puts the emphasis on the fact that he was very shrewd. The focus and the thing that Jesus wants us to learn from this character tonight is how we can be shrewd, wise. We can take action in our today that will lead to a better future for us. So in this parable, it's emphasizing the idea of investments, of how you use your investment, savings, and so forth. And that's something that we all, I think, try to teach our children as they grow up. I know one of the things my parents tried to help me do, we had these little booklets that we would get for free. And each week, we would come to school, and we would bring a 10-cent piece, a dime. And for a dime, we could trade that for a stamp. And we put a stamp in our book. And then we just keep putting in stamps every week. The more stamps, the quicker these books would fill up. I mean, I had several of these books that I was putting my stamps in and saving up because in the end, you can turn this booklet in and get money back. I was in sixth grade, so I wasn't real savvy with investments and savings at that time. But I thought, man, I think I'm going to be a millionaire by the time I'm 20. But in the end, after looking at the details, I see that each of these, after 10 years, is only worth $25. So it would have taken a lot of these for me to be a millionaire. I had the right heart, the right intentions to save and be ready for the future, but these weren't the best plan to take. But tonight, I think we can learn something from this parable that will help us to know how to make better investments to ensure a future that's bright in front of God. So let's take a look at this parable. Jesus is walking with many disciples. Now, let's turn to Luke chapter 16 and let me read, put us into the backdrop here, beginning with verse 1. Now, he was also saying, that's Jesus, was also saying to the disciples, there was a rich man who had a manager, and this manager was reported to him as squandering his possessions. And he called him and told him, what is this that I hear about you? Give an accounting of your management, for you can no longer be a manager. The manager said to himself, what shall I do? Since my master is taking the management away from me, I am not strong enough to dig. I am ashamed to beg. Ah! I know what I shall do, so that when I am removed from the management, people will welcome me into their homes. So he summoned each one of his master's debtors, and he began saying to the first, how much do you owe my master? And he said, 100 measures of oil. And he said to him, take your bill and set down quickly and write 50. In verse 7, he said to another, how much do you owe? And he said, 100 measures of wheat. And he said to him, take your bill and write 80. Verse 8, and his master praised the unrighteous manager because he had acted shrewdly. For the sons of this age are more shrewd in relation to their own kind than the sons of light. Verse 9 says, and I say to you, make friends for yourself by means of the wealth of unrighteousness, so that when it fails, they will receive you into the eternal dwellings. He who is faithful in a very little thing is faithful also in much, and he who is unrighteous in a very little thing is unrighteous also in much. Therefore, if you have not been faithful in the use of unrighteous wealth, who will entrust to you true riches? And if you have not been faithful in the use of that which is another's, who will give you that which is your own? No servant can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and wealth. Just by way of context again, Jesus has been addressing significant misunderstandings that the people have, and the people have them mostly because the religious leaders of that time had communicated this false teaching to them. They were believing things from the religious leaders that weren't really in line with God's truth. We saw in Luke chapter 15, in these parables of the lost sheep, the lost coin, and the lost sons, both sons were lost, that Jesus was trying to correct the wrong attitudes towards people. He was especially addressing those parables to the Pharisees and the scribes, who were the religious leaders, who were sneering at Jesus and accusing him of spending too much time with sinners and tax collectors. That's riffraff. God can't save them. God's not interested in them. That was what they had been communicating, but Jesus was spending time with them, and Jesus was seeing many of them repent and come to himself. So the right attitude is to rejoice with this. Don't make fun of it. Don't put it down. And that's what he was trying to teach the Pharisees and scribes. Now, in this chapter, we're just going to look at the first half tonight and the next half next week. They both have to do with having wrong attitudes towards mammon. Now, you'll notice I'm using an old word. This was a word that you'll find in the King James Bible. I doubt that if your modern translations have it, but I put it up there for a reason because it really is a little stronger than just the word money. Mammon includes money, but it's not just money. It's possession. So really, Jesus is not just talking about our use of money, but he's talking about in this parable our use of everything that he places in our hands. We're stewards of everything, not just the money or not just the 10% that you might think is God's part of that money. No, God says we're a steward of mammon, of everything that he puts in our hands, money and stuff, we could say. And that's what this parable is about. Now, I think as we see here, it says, now he was also saying to the, what's it say? Disciples. Now, a lot of times when we see that word disciples, we're so used to seeing it associated with the 12 disciples that are his inner circle that have been following him for 2.5, 3 years at this point. But there's not a number 12 here. So I want us to see that these disciples that Jesus was talking to here is more than the 12. And I think these disciples include some of those publicans or tax collectors and sinners that he had just mentioned in chapter 15. They were now disciples. They had repented. They had come to faith in Jesus Christ. Because this is a direct follow-up to what he has said in chapter 15. There's not necessarily a break in time between the parables about the lost sheep, coin, and sons. Jesus is following that teaching by trying to correct the wrong conception that the disciples might be picking up from those religious leaders, the Pharisees and the scribes. So Jesus focuses his attention to those disciples. So Jesus wanted them to know that, yes, money is important. At least a third of the parables that Jesus gives, 38 or 40, depending on how you count them, deal with money in some way. So this is an important topic for people to understand if they want to live out their discipleship, live out their kingdom citizenship in the proper way. And they were getting the wrong ideas from the Pharisees. Now, though Jesus was specifically addressing these believing followers, the Pharisees were also listening. We'll find that out in verse 14, where it says, now the Pharisees, who were lovers of money, were listening to all this. So they're still there in the crowd, but Jesus is really ignoring them. He's focusing on those who have repented and come to faith in him, so they have the right understanding. Now, this parable is about stewardship. Now, again, I put the word stewardship here. Probably a more modern name is manager, but they're not exactly the same. Often we think of a manager as somebody who may work 8 or 16 hours a day. The hours can be different, but it's a job. He goes from his house, he goes to work, he comes home. There's a beginning and an ending. He doesn't live at the factory normally. It's just a job, and he doesn't usually have all details under his control. He has certain areas of control or management for his job. Whereas a steward in that day was something far more comprehensive. A steward actually lived in the house. He basically lived like one of the family. He was part of the meals. He was part of everything that went on in the house. And he tended to have full control of everything related to that household. The master, or the one who had all the money, was entrusting everything to this person, and he didn't usually pay a lot of attention to the details. He trusted that man to take care of all of his possessions and finances and assets for his benefit. So we know from this story that he was a very wealthy person. The quantities of items that are mentioned, the debts that are going to be mentioned later in the passage, involve, we would say today, thousands of dollars, even thousands of acres of land. So he's also a large landowner. He had delegated complete management to this steward. If you want to see what that picture is like, read again this section out of Joseph's life, where Joseph was purchased by Potiphar in Genesis 39. You remember what it says about Potiphar? Potiphar said the only thing he troubled himself with, what he ate, and his wife was held off ground. Everything else was on Joseph. Don't bother me with the details, Joseph. Just take care of everything, except I'll feed myself and stay away from my wife. So that's the kind of delegation that was going on here. Complete delegation. But now, in verse 1, it's been reported to him by some unknown persons that he was squandering his resources. Now, we came across that word in our study of the prodigal son. Remember, the prodigal son demanded his inheritance now, and it says he squandered that inheritance. And we said that's the same word that's used in Matthew 13 in the parable of the sower. To sow the seed, that was throwing it out. So the picture here is that this steward was tossing out this other man's money. He was squandering it. He wasn't carefully accounting for everything. Now, I want to clarify that because a lot of Bible teachers or commentaries that you read on this accuse the guy of stealing. That's not what the accusation is from the text it says. It doesn't say he was stealing. It says he was squandering. The idea I get here is that this guy, over time, I think he got a little looser every year probably that he was doing this, but the idea is that if he had to travel and do business, he just didn't stay in a 2-star hotel, but he would take the Mövenpick or the Marriott. Or when he went to buy things, he wouldn't just buy exactly what, oh, give me 5 of those or 10 of these. Or in hiring people, okay, yep, give me 10 workers, we'll get the job done. And when he ate, okay, give me the mansif, you know, put the whole spread out for me every time. So it's like there's no caution, there's no budgeting involved here. So he was just spending money as if there was no end to it. That's the idea here of squandering, just tossing out this money because it wasn't his. In the end, it was his master. So it wasn't any hardship on him. That's the picture going on here. Okay, but the guy heard this report. And so in verse 2, he says, he called him and said to him, what is this that I hear about you? Give an accounting of your management, for you can no longer be manager. So it's like he didn't actually fire him yet. He couldn't because it would be a mess. The books weren't being kept. The accounting wasn't being done. So he says, tidy up the books, bring them to me. And if they show what I think they show, you're done. So the steward, again, to understand it as a first century listener would have understood it, he had full legal authority. He could buy any properties, he could sell any properties, he could make any investment, he could liquidate any investment that this master had, he could buy more animals, he could do whatever he wanted. He had complete authority, complete power of attorney, I think we would say today, to do whatever he wanted in the name of that master. So the basic job description is make me money. I'm going to let you have access to everything because in the end, I want to be better off because you're my steward than I was before you started. So just keep me in mind and take care of me. I just like my comfortable lifestyle over here. So the rest is up to you. So he was supposed to be looking after the master's benefit to increase his profit and resources, but that's not what was really happening. He may be making profits here and there, but as fast as he was making any, he was spending them. He was squandering these resources. So he saw that the end was coming from that master saying, tidy up the books and then come to me and you're fired. I'm going to let you go. So he saw the end coming. Now, this is an important detail in this story to understand. It's when you are confronted with this uncomfortable news about your future, the question is, what are you going to do about it? Some people just fold, just start crying and whining. Oh, me, or trying to get pity from other people on their circumstances. If this man had done that, he'd have been gone. He would have had no future after that point. But when he saw the end coming, he did something. It says he considered his options. Now, it actually gives 3 in the text. In verse 3, he says, what shall I do since my master is in the process of taking the management away from me? I know I'm going to be replaced. So I just have this short window of time that he's giving me to get the books in order, to figure out a plan of action. I've got a tight window here, and I've got to act fast. I've got to come up with a plan so that I'll have a future. Because if I get fired, no one else will hire me. My reputation is ruined. Nobody else wants an unfaithful steward. So he said, I've got to work out a plan. What is it? Well, let's see. I guess I could be a day laborer. And we see those. at different parts of the city, right? You drive by certain corners, and if you want a carpenter, you just look for the guy that has the saw, and you pick him out. Or the guy that does the clipping and pruning of the trees, he's got his tools all there. You walk by, you hire him for a certain amount of money. And that's how people on that day work. If they didn't have a particular skill or their own business, then they had to hire themselves out for the day and work. Usually they were 12-hour workdays. And a lot of it would involve digging because it was an agricultural society. So he thought, I'm not strong enough to dig. You know, I'm kind of used to this cushy life. I've been staying at the 5-star hotels. I've been eating from the banquets, and I put on a little weight, and my muscles are not so much. To put me out there, I'm going to have a heart attack. I'm not going to last a week. 12-hour work days. That's not for me. Then he says, well, psychologically, I'm unprepared to beg. How can I, who's stayed in the 5-star hotels, who's tipped big, how can I stand out in front of that same hotel and put my hands out there like this and ask for alms? Can't do that. Psychologically, I'm not ready for that. So then he says, I have the plan. He says, I have a plan now that when I lose this job, which I probably will, that there'll be people out there that will be glad to welcome me into their house. So I'll just go from one house to the other for the rest of my life and I'll be taken care of. And so that's the plan he puts into action, this third plan. So he's in the friendship-making business now. He says, I got a lot of friends to make now, and I need to make them so deep that they're going to welcome me into their house when I lose my living situation here in the master's house. So it says that the steward summoned all of the creditors, verse 5, and he summoned each one of his master's debtors. Okay, these were people that owed the master. So I want us to see there were many of these debtors. They're only going to list two situations, but that's just to give us an idea of the degree of debt that was out there and help us to understand what the man was doing for this. So he said, what I'm going to do to make friends today is significantly reduce each of these contracts. I'm going to make it so they don't have to pay back as much. They'll be able to pay back sooner. They'll love me for that. And they'll have no problems with sharing their goodness, their wealth with me later on after I lose this job. And I can do it because I'm still representing the master. I'm still able to do everything in his name. I haven't been removed yet. But the big question is, what's he up to? Is he going to cheat the master out of some money? Is he going to start thieving now? That's what some people think. But as I've looked at it and studied the culture, I don't think that's what's going on here. So let me explain my understanding of it. Basically, the Old Testament law said that a fellow Hebrew could not charge another Hebrew usury or interest. In other words, we're all part of that Old Testament culture. You came to me and you needed 100 shekels from me and I loaned it to you. Then all you had to ever pay back was 100 shekels. I couldn't charge you one shekel interest. Even if you were late in your payments, I could not charge interest. That's what God said to keep the economy working in that society. No interest. Now, if you loan outsiders money, get what you can. So that's how they were to make more money, by charging interest from peoples who were not part of that Old Testament society. So Deuteronomy 23:19, and there's verses in Leviticus and Exodus that say the same thing, but basically it says, you shall not charge interest to your countrymen. Now, when any rule is created, creativity goes to work, and people try to figure out, how can I get around that rule? They want to make money, so how can I charge interest without making myself legally liable in my society? Because if you charge your fellow countrymen interest, they could take you to court. And you could be fined or imprisoned for breaking the law. So what did they do? How did they scheme to add on interest? They got pretty creative. What they would do is, let's say if a man borrowed 50 measures of olive oil, then they wouldn't write up the contract for 50 measures of olive oil plus interest. But what they would do is they would calculate interest into the final total on the contract. Now, for instance, for olive oil was a very risky commodity because it varied greatly from year to year as to how much rain they had. And the amount of rain determines what? The size and juiciness of the olives. So if you had a good year this year and you loaned a lot out, then next year they had a poor year, they couldn't pay it back. So that's why they would charge higher interest rates to cover such losses and situations. So for olive oil, they have records showing that they charged up to 100% interest for that. So if you borrowed 50 and the interest rate was 100%, that means they're going to add another 50 measures on. So the total that they're going to write on the contract is you owe 100 measures of olive oil. So now, let's see what this guy does. So let me start reading again from verse 5. So he summoned each one of his master's debtors, and he began saying to the first, "How much do you owe my master?" And he said, 100 measures of oil. And he said to him, "Take your bill and sit down quickly and write 50. So this is what the contract said. He said, "Here's your contract. Here's the record I have of our agreement where it said you owe 100. Now, we both know that you only borrowed 50, but the interest was 50, so we said the total is 100. But what I'm going to let you do, this is a once-in-a-lifetime deal. What I want you to do quickly, notice that word quickly, is sit down and change the amount to 50. Wow! Would you like the bank to come to you and say, "Well, I know you owe me 10,000 JDs for the car, but you know what? Today and today only, take that contract and cut it in half." Would you like that? You'd be going back to that guy again for the next loan. You know, he's got your loyalty because he just did something for you that nobody else has ever done. And that's the picture here. So quickly and gladly, these people who owed on the olive oil were glad to change that. Now, this is again why we know that he was a large landowner and very wealthy. This amount of 100 measures of olive oil was like almost 675 gallons. Almost 4,000 liters of olive oil. And they said it would take 150 olive trees to produce that amount. And this is only one guy. And remember, he called each of the guys. So there were many people who owed olive oil. So this guy owned massive amounts of lands and olive groves. And so that's what's going on. I don't think the man was cheating the boss. He didn't take from the principal that the master had put up for this loan debt, but he just cut the illegal interest off of it. So that's what I think is going on here. It also happened, the other example that is given, in verse 7, he said to another, "How much do you owe?" And he said, 100 measures of wheat. And he said to him, "Take your bill and write 80. So again, he had borrowed 80, because that's what it seems to be cut to. And again, from historical documents, we know that a typical interest rate on wheat was not as high. It was 20%, and so that is what made the 100. So the contract, again, was written as 100 measures of wheat, which would have been 1,000 bushels of wheat in modern terms today. So he said, sit down and write quickly, 80. He's taken off the interest again. He's just cutting the interest and peeling it down to the initial loan as it should have been written up. To grow this amount of wheat alone would have taken 100 acres, so that's like, I think, 400 dunams. So again, this was just one of many people that owed for wheat commodities. So this man was very, very wealthy. But what was happening is he was being peeled down to the principal and not being really cheated out of any of his own funds that he had put up. So I believe, anyway, as I study this parable out, that the steward was just canceling the interest. He had the authority to do it. What he did was completely legal. In fact, it was just. It was the right thing to do. And he made many friends that day, many strong, deep friendships that day for all the money that he saved these other people. And his future now was assured. He had so many people that got so much money back that they wouldn't have had to pay back that they would be glad to help host and provide hospitality for this person. He may not have thought about it before, but he also made the master look generous. Because who was he doing the business in the name of? The master. So his quick planning and his action really changed his fate. So instead of being out on his own, lost, nowhere to go, he now had many places he could go to, and everybody thought well of him and thought well of his master. So what did the master do? The master praised him for what? Being shrewd. Now here's this word, shrewd. Wise. Taking action in light of your future. You see the future coming and you take action that's going to improve that future for you. Now, maybe it put the master in a kind of an awkward situation because he couldn't go back and say, no, I want that interest on there. Because then that generous new reputation that he had would be wiped out. He would be the villain. And if he charged interest, they could take you to court and he could be fined or imprisoned for breaking the law. And not many people would want to do business with him after that. So really, they all came out winners. The steward came out a winner. The borrowers came out a winner. They had to pay back less. And even the master, his name was touted among the community, and he was looked at as a very generous man. Now, I think we get to the heart of what Jesus is trying to say. So let me read some more verses here. to see the praise from the master. Verse 8, and his master praised the unrighteous manager because he had acted shrewdly. For the sons of this age are more shrewd in relation to their own kind than the sons of light. In the second half of the verse, we see Jesus starting to kind of summarize some principles for us to take from this parable. What he's saying here is, you know, unbelievers, the children of this world, they know what kind of future they want. They know what the world tells them they should have, and they work hard to get it. You know, they're 24/7 going after all the toys and all the pleasures and joys that this life has to offer, because for them, that's it. That's what is in this life that counts. And so they work hard to get everything. In fact, one of the pop phrases, I've seen it on bumper stickers in the United States as I was driving out. There's a guy in a big, massive $70,000 pickup truck, and it said, "The boys with the most toys win." That's the world's philosophy. In other words, get all you can. Enjoy everything you can. Get your boat, get your motorcycle, get your car, get your truck, get your villa, get. Because it's only what you have in this life that counts. And so Jesus is saying, well, at least they see what's the goal for their way of thinking, and they go after it hard. And he says, I wish the sons of light would do the same. So who are the sons of light? That's you and me. You see, sometimes we get caught up with that same philosophy. Maybe we think the boys or girls with the most toys are the ones that win. But that's not true, is it? No, we know different. It says in Ecclesiastes chapter 5, verse 15, the writer Solomon says, naked we came from our mother's womb, and so we will return as we came. We will take nothing with us. Now, who was Solomon who wrote this? He was somebody who had gathered all the toys. He had everything. He had 1,000 wives. He had properties and accomplishments and patents and everything, okay? But he says, in the end, I can't take none of it with me. And I like what he said in 2:19. A little early, he had said, who knows what's going to happen when I die? If who I give this over to is going to be wise or foolish? So even at the end, when you pass it on to somebody else, you don't know what's going to happen to it. It's just vanity, vanity. So don't get caught up in the world's philosophy of grabbing everything and keeping it for yourself. What Jesus wants us to know, and he talks about it here. Let me just keep reading on here because several of these principles overlap. Verse 9 says, and I say to you, make friends for yourself by means of the wealth of unrighteousness, so that when it fails, that wealth, money fails, they will receive you into the eternal dwellings. He who is faithful in a very little thing is faithful also in much, and he who is unrighteous in a very little thing is unrighteous also in much. Therefore, if you have not been faithful in the use of unrighteous wealth, who will entrust to you true riches? And if you have not been faithful in the use of that which is another's, who will give you that which is your own? No servant can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and wealth. Mammon. So that's what he's getting to in these points here. So he says, basically, a believer, a son of light, needs to think about his future. And your ultimate future is where? It's not here on this earth. So don't get caught up in trying to accumulate everything here, because you can't take any of that with you where you're going. Think about heaven and put some treasures up there, because one day you and I, who know Jesus Christ, will be standing before him at what's called the judgment seat of Christ. That's what 2 Corinthians 5:10 says. It says, for we must all stand before the judgment seat of Christ and give an account of the things that we have done in the body while we were here on this earth. How did we live our life? How did we spend what went through our hands? How did we take care of and steward the stuff, the places, the car, the education, and all the other things that God has placed in our hand? That's what we're going to have to give an account for someday. So in closing, I just share a few thoughts that came to my mind. First of all of us need to recognize we're only stewards. We are not owners of anything. God put stuff in our hands while we're here on this earth. Health, life, job, maybe a wife or husband, some children, a job, car, home. But this is not yours. It doesn't matter whose name is on the title. In the end, it's not really yours. And you need to recognize who gave it to you. I love this verse from David, who has just given billions. He's accumulated billions of gold, silver, bronze, materials for the building of the temple that his son would do. And at the end, he says in 1 Chronicles 29:14, but who am I and who are my people that we should be able to offer as generously as this? For all things come from you, and from your hand we have given back to you. So it's not just taking 10% of what God may give you and thinking that's generous to give back to God. God's not just cared about your tithe, whatever that happens to be, but he cares about the whole 100%. How are you using it? That doesn't mean you can't use that for your own needs and even for your own pleasure at times, but it's just a mentality thing. Do you see yourself as an owner, or do you see yourself as a steward, somebody that's here to manage what God has put in your hand for the period of your life? So think of yourself as a steward, number one. Number two, learn to invest your money, your possessions, and time to enhance your welcome into heaven. That's what verse 9 was saying. Make friends for yourselves by means of this money, so that when it fails, when you no longer have access to it, when you're dead, when you're gone, when you're in heaven, that there'll be people there in the eternal dwellings who will welcome you. So what it's saying is, use your money so that other people come to the Lord, so that they'll be there welcoming you when your time on earth is done. You need to invest in ministries, in missionaries, in churches, in programs that help other people come to faith in the Lord Jesus Christ, so that they will be there waiting for you when you get there and be grateful for the $5 you sent to help get something translated or to buy a New Testament or a gospel tract or a radio program. I just brought a couple pictures here. This is from my childhood. There was a man, a farmer in the same state where I grew up, and he got saved later in life. And he had made money farming, and he said, Lord, what can I do to invest in your work? He felt the Lord had him to make a Bible camp. So he converted all of his farmland into a Christian camp. That barn there, it used to hold animals, and it smelled like it for a few years after he did that. Okay, I mean, that was where the boys slept. The girls had specially new-built cabins on other parts of the campus. But he dedicated that campground to the Lord. And each year, 300, 400, 500, 600 young people would come, many of whom came to the Lord over those years. And even at the end of his life, he donated that camp to Moody Bible Institute so they could send people down and continue to run the camp. Mr. Duckles invested what he had to see thousands of people come to faith in Jesus Christ and serve him, and they're in many countries all around the world today because he invested in the short life that he had for the work of the Lord. I think of another man here. This is a personal friend. His name is Merv. God gave him a super mechanical ability. I mean, this guy could take anything apart and put it back together better than it was, even brand new. He just had a gift. He taught me how to work on cars. Every time I'd be out hot rodding my car and break something or blow something, I'd say, Merv! And he'd come over and he'd fix my car. But it wasn't just me. My dad was a pastor and a missionary. And whenever his car had trouble, Merv would take care of it, fix it, not charge anything. He did that for many people in the church. I don't know how many hundreds or thousands of dollars worth of work he did for people, but he did it. Why? This is what the Lord gave me, and I want to invest it in the Lord's work. So he did, and many people were blessed by that. Here's another man. His name is Letourneau. I want to Google this sometime and just see what this man did. This man had over 300 patents. Well, they called him the greatest earth mover builder. He built some of the first big bulldozers. He built 50,000 miles of our interstate highways in the U.S. And this guy, he was a Christian. And above all, he said, I'm dedicating 90% of what I make to the Lord. I'm going to live on 10%. And that's what he practiced for decades in his life. And God blessed him and used him in a great way. So these are just a few examples. If you give a glass of water in the name of Jesus, he can use that and bless that. God wants to use you. He wants to use your stuff. He wants to use you. So the question I want to ask you is, will anyone be in heaven because of what you personally invested, what you personally gave? Third, faithfulness and stewardship begins now with little things. He says in there, he was faithful in a very little thing is also faithful in much. I know we like to kid ourselves sometimes and say, if I made more money or if I had $1 million, then I would sure give a lot more. That's not true. There's research to prove it. They've studied areas that had increases of up to 50% in income. The giving only increased 2%. So seldom does giving increase proportionally. Teach your kids to give, but don't put the money in their hand to give, okay, parents? It's just teaching them you're going to give them money to give. Make them earn their own money that they're learning to put their own money in to the church. And if they develop that habit when they're children, we would be in a lot better position now as churches today. Wasting your money and opportunities limits how much God will use you now and reward you later. That's what he's saying in here. If you can't take care of and make proper use of the money that he puts in your hand, how will God trust you with more valuable things? Spiritual riches. So use what you have. Don't waste it. Become shrewd. Act quickly to maximize your treasures in heaven by the way that you invest your resources in God's work here on earth. Philippians 4, 15 through 17 is where Paul is writing the Philippian believers and saying, thank you for giving. You know, even after I left your area of Macedonia, you gave to me again. You were the only church that did that. Even when I went to Thessaloniki, you sent me a gift. And he said, it's not that I desire the gift for the gift's sake itself, but he says, I'm desiring that fruit will abound to your spiritual account. In other words, he's saying, when you give to the work of the Lord, when you give to a missionary, a pastor, a Christian worker, Bible translator, or whatever the ministry is, it says your spiritual count goes up. That's how you lay up treasures in heaven, by using your money to support God's work here on earth. God, I just want to encourage you. The time's clicking. I don't know how many years you have left in your life, but the time is still clicking away. And this is what the steward did. He saw he had a short window of time, and he says, I'm going to maximize it. I'm not going to wait. I'm going to go to work to make my future better. And that's what Jesus, in the end, is trying to tell those who were listening to him in that day, and I think you and I tonight. Father, thank you that you are the giver of everything. Every good and perfect gift comes from you, and we thank you for that. Our health, our life, our strength, the skills that you've allowed us to accumulate, the money, the possessions, the friends, our education, everything, Lord, you gave it to us. Help us to find ways to make use of all of these gifts so that you get the honor and credit and other people come to you through it. This I pray in Jesus' name. Amen.